committee meeting for the Board of Regents. We have the agenda, and before we get started, Dr. Ransell has a few announcements.
Well, I have a few things. I will start with some board member rather important business. First of all, you're aware of Patty's decision, and Patty, we look forward to saluting and celebrating with you these next couple of meetings, your contributions, and I know it's an important moment in your professional career with all of your scholarly activity, and there is a lot. So I know the board will share in giving you a salute these next couple of months.
Thank you. And
Patty will serve until a new faculty regent is elected, and that new faculty regent we just discussed will be sworn in at the January meeting, so Patty will be a regent through the October meeting and, well, until a new regent is sworn in. So we salute you.
Thank you. I just found out, I need to do another graduation.
Right.
But that's okay. I like graduation. I was going to be there anyway.
The University Senate has been very thorough in putting material out that will guide those who choose to run for this important position and help them through that process. So those candidates, I'm sure, will become known in the weeks ahead. I do also want, and I just learned this, I knew she was getting married, but I didn't know it was like Sunday. Nikki, wow, what a great way to spend the day before your wedding.
Yeah.
Nikki's getting married in Cocoa Beach on Sunday. Fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Great. And you'll be back before our October 31st meeting, won't you?
Oh, definitely. unless I like it too much down there.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Fantastic. And Cynthia, congratulations to your husband for being recognized in the Governor's Awards in the Arts. He is the Artist Award recipient for 2014 from the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And that ceremony will take place on October 9 in Frankfurt. And so please extend our congratulations to Larnell. What a great honor for you
and your
family and for WKU.
Yes.
So, yes.
Yes, definitely.
Yes. Please convey our congratulations. For our students, Nikki may have already made note of this, but I was just informed that Steak and Shake officially opened today on campus. So there you go. For our students, that may be the most important thing that happens today on campus. A couple things with that I just want to make the board briefly aware of. I did receive a report this week on what we are doing, more importantly, what we're not doing with regard to Ebola in West Africa. We only have one student in Africa currently, and that student is in Morocco, which would be safe. We have some students on the semestered sea voyage this fall, but that voyage has been redirected away from West Africa and will go through Morocco and then through the Mediterranean rather than through their normal trip of West Africa down to South Africa. But we are monitoring State Department notices and warnings. We monitor news outlets. We have canceled a couple of programs headed to Africa this year. And we are waiting to see whether some faculty-led study abroad programs in Ghana that are scheduled for 2015 will take place or not. But we're on top of it. We're not going to do anything that would put either our students or faculty at risk in any of the countries where Ebola has been detected. So I just wanted to, sometimes things occur and unfold, and they might not be on the board agenda, but it's important for you to know. And in that regard, Vice President Bayless, a student developed an app that is helping track the spread of Ebola. Get that a Cliff Notes 30-second description.
So you can get this from the iTunes or Android store. It's the Ebola Project, and basically it was a graduate student here in Armin Smail-Hotik and his faculty advisor Keith Andrew in the physics department. Basically, people will chatter about Ebola long, as in days, before the authorities know that Ebola is in a location. So if you can listen into Twitter feeds and other social media feeds, you might get a head start on where Ebola's going and how fast it's spreading. And that's what this app does. and it seems to be ahead of everybody else's predictions. Just by kind of listening to what people out there are saying about, oh, it looks like Granny's got Ebola or something. You know, you hear that days before an official case is registered. And, you know, a few days might be a major help in dealing with this. We're working on making connections with the appropriate people, such as WHO, CDC, and Médecins Sans Frontières.
Really a cool use of technology.
Yeah.
I want to circulate too, and I'll send these around. Just circulate them and pass them through if you'll bring them around the other way. But I have a series that you might be interested to know of publications, all in different languages, and I have one in each of the languages that I'm going to keep those.
Okay.
That these have been printed in that might give you some indication of the complexity and the pervasiveness of our international recruitment. So these are WKU recruitment pieces in Vietnamese, Persian, Portuguese, Spanish, Arabic, and Chinese that we are now circulating broadly across the globe to recruit the international marketplace for WKU. So I thought you might just get a kick out of seeing how those work. And so just send those around. Everybody, I'm sure, will be able to read all of each of them. finally, tonight, two events. A Love for China program that is the theater and dance and music troupe from our partner university in Beijing, North China Electric Power University. And yes, it is a technology-driven university, but they have a splendid visual and performing arts program at NCEPU. And it's a very large program. They hosted our symphony orchestra last May when our symphony did a tour of China and had a great performance in a wonderful concert hall on their campus. And they're sending their talented students here for performance tonight at the SkyPack at 6 o'clock. And some of you may already be aware of that. And then our symphony is performing tonight as well in a concert called Be Our Guest. The Three Phantoms concert and its Broadway music that you might enjoy. Information about both of those events are in your package. And also there is a calendar and information in front of you of events throughout the next couple of months that you will be receiving invitations to. And so I just call those to your attention. None of them are command performances, except maybe board committee meetings. but they're all events that you may have interest in. Obviously, the fourth quarterly meeting of the board on the 31st. But, for example, General Bolden, who's the chief administrator for NASA, will be on campus, and we'll be doing a dinner for him at the president's home, and you'll be invited to that. And then homecoming activities. You'll be invited to a breakfast on the morning of the Army game on November 15, where we will be entertaining Superintendent Robert Caslin, the superintendent of West Point, who will be in town for our game with Army, and then obviously our holiday dinner and commencement. But those dates will be helpful for you to just make note of. And then finally, there's a copy of the article that was in the Daily News just a couple of days ago on Tuesday. Chuck Mason wrote a terrific article on the restoration, the preservation and restoration of the original president's home, into which my office has now been moved. And I want to invite all the board, when we finish our meeting today, I'll go back and I would welcome any of you to come and walk through that building and take a look, and we'll have something in there coming up at one of our upcoming meetings. But I would welcome any of you to come back with me after our meeting, and we'd be glad to show you that great preservation project of one of the original nine buildings on our campus. And it was one of the original designs of Brenton Davis, the original campus architect and campus planner from 1906 to 1936. So it's quite a historic building, and it's been a good preservation project. So I'll be glad to show you around. Those are my announcements, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. We'll have the report of the Academic Affairs Committee, Dr. Bale.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a relatively brief but always important agenda. And since we've talked about the importance of listening already, I think it's appropriate that our first item concerns a doctor in psychology and applied psychology. So, Mr. Provost, if you would.
Thank you, sir. Before I get to that, a couple of brief introductions I'd like to make. First, sitting behind me is Ms. Tiffany Robinson. Stand up. Say hi. Tiffany is our new registrar. It comes to us from Southern Illinois University Carbondale, where she was director of the Office of the Registrar and has over 15 years in higher education, bringing with her a wealth of knowledge and experience in the realm of things like curriculum, registration, records keeping, imaging, graduation, banner security, compliance, and catalog preparation, which is what a registrar does. I can assure you, in my interaction with Tiffany so far, she is knowledgeable, she's responsive, she gets things done incredibly quickly and efficiently, and has absolutely hit the ground running. So welcome, Tiffany. Seated to Tiffany's right, two over, is Dr. Lynette Breedlove. Lynette? Dr. Breedlove is the new director of the Gatton Academy of Math and Science. That's a little high school just up the road there you may have heard of. She comes to us from Spring Branch near Houston, Texas, where she was director of advanced academic studies and secondary counseling in a school district serving over 34,000 students. Very active in gifted education at local, state, and national levels, having conducted professional development presentations and parent workshops across Texas and beyond. Currently serves as the Education Committee Chair with the National Association for Gifted Children and is the Treasurer of the Association of the Gifted. She's settling extremely well, and she has a tough act to follow. As you're aware, she now is director of the number one high school in the country for 3 years in a row.
No pressure at all.
Okay, as we can both point out, our first action item is a request approval for a Doctor of Psychology degree. This requires both the approval of that degree type, the PSYD degree designation, and the first program in that type, which should be a Doctor of Psychology in Applied Psychology. Several representatives of the college and the department seated behind me, I'll hand them over to them in a minute, but for the board, I'd like to point out that this would be considered an advanced practice doctoral program as prescribed by KRS 164-295. This would be WKU's fourth such program. And Eastern Kentucky's Doctor of Psychology program was approved by the CPE at their meeting last month, and that leaves two so-called at-large programs beyond the two assigned to each one of the comprehensive universities. Pending board approval, we'll send this to CPE, where we hope they will consider it this fall, with an implementation date of fall 2015. Notably, this being our fourth doctoral program will elevate us to SACS Level 6. The Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges recognizes six levels of four-year institution. Level 6 is the highest. That's four doctoral degrees and upward, and this degree would take us to that level. And with that, I believe Dr. Fred Grieve is going to... there you go. We'll discuss the program. Go ahead.
Thank you. As we detail in our proposal, the needs for mental health treatment are increasing. More and more people are becoming diagnosed with mental health issues, and there just aren't enough people out there to help serve them. And this program, this program is designed to meet that need in a couple of different ways. First of all, we put practitioners out on the ground, people who will be in the field serving needed populations. Secondly, one of the focuses of the program is on supervision, and that will allow the doctoral level people to supervise master's level practitioners who can also be in the field. So we will increase the number of practitioners dealing with this lack of treatment in those two ways. And I think WKU is in a good position to address some of these needs. Number one, we are, if you draw a circle around Bowling Green, You have to go out about 2 hours, hour and a half, before you find the next doctoral program. There are a couple of programs in Nashville. There's a program or two in Louisville, and then we've got some out in Lexington. But they are a ways away. So we do have a regional draw to the campus for students. The program is designed to have a couple of unique features. One of which is that what we're calling an add-on program. You have to have a master's degree in order to be accepted into the program. And we're really looking for motivated, good students. So we will cast a wide net there. We can look for people with psychology degrees. We can look for people with counseling degrees. We can look for people with other master's degrees, social work, or business degrees. We're looking for motivated students who can come in and do the work. Now, we know that because we're looking at people who already have master's degrees who will probably be out working, we've designed the program to be offered in non-traditional time slots, at least at the beginning until we get some more traditional students coming through. So we're going to be looking at evening and maybe one day. So initially, one thought we had would be to have one class Tuesday night, one class Wednesday night, and two classes Friday, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. That still leaves people time during the week to pursue jobs and work full-time if they needed to. We have the program has two components to it. It has a clinical psychology specialization and a school psychology specialization. Within the state of Kentucky, there is only one other university that offers a doctoral degree in school psychology, that's the University of Kentucky. So there is a definite need there for doctoral level practitioners within the school psych setting. We think that we have put together a unique program that will train good practitioners that will help meet the needs of the region and the state. And I'd be open for questions.
If I may, I see a lot of your colleagues here.
Sure.
Who have helped to create this program. If you wouldn't mind just introducing your colleagues so that the board can
find
out who's been working on this program.
This is the Department of Psychology is behind me. We'll start here on the end with our co-department head, Steve Weiniger, and then industrial organizational psychologist who will be doing, he's also doing cross-cultural things, and so he'll be working with our students on cross-cultural classes is Tony Paquin. Next to him is Pitt Derryberry, our other co-department head. And then Carl Myers will be directing the school psychology specialization for the PsyD program. Next to him is Bill Fohl, who is also a school psychologist and is very active within the professional organizations for school psychology. And then next to me here is Sally Kulischmidt, who will be my partner in the clinical specialization. So I will head up the clinical side of the program as well as coordinate the whole thing.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, if you're gonna bring everybody here, might as well show them off, right?
Was it true that was allowed?
Oh, absolutely. This is exactly when it's allowed. One other question, assuming approval this fall at the CPE, which obviously we hope happens, when will you begin to solicit and review applications for that first cohort? I know you mentioned that you might do it a little non-traditionally at first,
right.
But what do you see your timeline as?
Well, when we first started thinking this whole program might go through, we have identified some former students from here who we thought would be good candidates for that first class. So we've already been in discussion with some people. Ideally you would like to have doctoral program decisions made in January, but this first year probably we won't be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be pushed back. I would say we would make it in February.
Okay.
But assuming approval in November, we could get applications and had some preliminary discussions with graduate studies about what needs to happen to get those online. So I, I, you know, probably February, if not March. But again, we've already talked with some folks, and I've had inquiries as word has gotten out that this program has moved forward. We've had inquiries about, you know, what's the availability. So we've got a list of people that we will say, hey, now's the time, let's go do it, and I think they will be ready for it.
And I saw in your material that you're looking for typically an enrollment of about 20. Is that your target?
Yes, 10 per year, about 20, and that would be full-time students.
Right.
I think there's a little wiggle room for maybe two or three students a year to come part-time as well, but really the bulk of it will be those 10 students a year that are full-time students.
Carl Myers and Bill Fole. I'm Dr. Dennison. I had your name on many things. I'm just glad to put a face with a name. You guys do a tremendous job, and definitely, oh my gosh, do we need this so badly? Because my question is how do you fund psychologists? I'm sure with the school psychologists, the school puts that bill. You know, do private payers pay psychologists? Probably not real well. Medicaid, probably nothing. I could use a psychologist in my practice.
Right.
I mean,
right. Well, psychologists can actually bill under behavioral health codes. I don't know the code numbers right now off the top of my head. I know when I do my private practice, it's a 906 number under the code, is that right?
There's 10 codes.
Yeah, there's 10 codes that we can bill under that get reimbursed by third-party payers and Medicare, or Medicare, Medicaid, which is poorly, but there are people that make livings doing that.
Right. All health care panels do cover us, as long as we're a licensed psychologist, and the doctoral level will allow that to happen. So Medicaid, Medicare, all the TRICARE, which is a big need here in this area because of the two military bases. There's very few providers here for TRICARE. So the military has to go further to get services.
As far as writing medications?
We do not do that.
You have to be an MD.
So there really needs to be a great, you know, collaboration between psychologists and MDs.
Absolutely. And that's a model that Bill has talked about. I think the profession tends to be moving towards group practices with, you know, where it's physical health, mental health, all combined in together there. So you've got, you know, physicians and psychologists, psychiatrists working together within a primary care type of setting.
I have one question, if I may. I read here, and I did not see the budget. I think I probably paged through this very quickly. But can you elaborate just a little bit? It is a self-sustaining program,
it
tuition, and then the fees, I think, that you were just referring to.
Well, no, she was actually talking more professional.
Oh, okay.
Professional pays. The program itself is self-sustaining through student tuition and fees. We budgeted based on expectations for 10 students, 20 students a year coming in full time. So anything that we get above that is beneficial, I guess.
Yeah.
But the budget itself is evens out.
Let me address that real quick. My statute. These professional doctoral programs must be financially self-sustaining, and what we've done to ensure that is we create a separate index account, if you like, within the university, where the tuition would flow. And this program will require 4.5 FTE new faculty, and they'll be hired outside of our usual what we call the staffing plan.
Mm-hmm.
So this program, very similar to our nursing practice, physical therapy, and EDD programs, will be, you know, self-sustaining, and evidently so. We're audited on these once a year by the CPE to ensure that dollars to run these programs are generated by those programs.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Well, which means our doctoral programs are on a different financing model than undergraduate master's programs from a university budgeting standpoint when you approve a budget.
Okay.
We have an excellent 67-page
thing
that...
To quote our board chair yesterday, and we talked, he said, wow, that's a thorough proposal.
Yeah. Well, I was going to comment on that. The reason the graduate school, Carl, has decided in order to essentially save on paperwork, believe it or not, because a proposal has to go through an internal review, board review, CP review, SACS review, and so it was decided for the graduate programs to use the CPE form. So this is the exact proposal that will be submitted to the CPE. We don't take the same information and recast it. And the CPE asks, you know, a variety of questions, and these are the answers to them there. That's get used to. For graduate programs, you're going to start seeing 60-page proposals. That's what we're using internally as well to avoid duplication.
One quick question. So when is, presuming this passes the full board, when does this hit the CPE agenda?
No, November 21
okay.
is the targeted CPE meeting.
Okay.
And assuming approval at that point, you can then implement. We also have to send a prospectus to SACS.
Okay.
And that will be after, you know, assuming full board approval, we send them a prospectus because it's a new degree type.
Thank you.
It's been through the CPE 45-day review
period.
Yes, thank you. It has, with no comment whatsoever, other than we welcome a full proposal, and we have prepared a response to those comments. There were no other institutional comments. The council staff requested a few clarifications.
Any other questions? Okay, before I call this for a vote, I want to make a few comments, and I appreciate Dr. Dennison's practical thing, and I'd like to elaborate a little bit on that. And in doing so, brought with me today, and I've shared with a few people here, but a recent article in the medical literature that really points out that this is propitious timing for Western to be doing this. And there's lots of data out there on it, but behavioral health interventions have been shown to increase efficiency and decrease costs of health care, which, in other words, adds value to a system that is sorely lacking in it. And Kentucky, as most of you know, ranks really at the bottom of the bottom when it comes to mental health services. As a primary care provider myself, and as Dr. Dennison has alluded to, you know, this is very much needed help that those of us out there in the trenches need to provide better health care to people. I think one of the interesting things that speaks to Dr. Dennison's comment, though, is that we really are on the cusp of a transformation of health care, and I predict within 5 years, fee-for-service will no longer be the predominant method of payment. And when that happens, these services become very valuable. When you have accountable care organizations that are accepting bundled payments for populations, then things that increase efficiency and decrease costs are going to be extremely valuable. And so mental health providers, there will be a mechanism that will reward that and should. So I think that's important for us to recognize looking in the not very distant future. The other point I wanted to make is, as a function of a university, hopefully adding new knowledge, bringing new things that can be applied for the public good, I think we have a unique opportunity right here on campus now, and I would encourage the psychology department to look next door, where there are people coming through now in droves every day with mental health needs, have conversations with those providing that care next door, and we can produce some real valuable research on the ground, in the trenches, real research that could impact a much broader area than just South Central Kentucky.
I assume you're mentioning, you're describing the health center.
Yeah.
Yeah, that and our counseling center, which is an integral part of our student affairs and portfolio.
And we are moving toward a team matter, collaboration, and mental health folks need to be right there shoulder to shoulder with the primary care providers, whoever they are, whether it's a doctoral nurse practitioner that Western has trained, and I have one in my office who is fantastic, or MDs or whomever can write the prescriptions. But this is a very important project, and I would hope that in years to come we can all look back on this and pat ourselves on the back and say we were a little forward-looking, maybe more so than others. So, not to belabor that any further, I'll ask if anyone else has any comments, and if not, I'll ask the members of the academic committee to vote. All those in favor of this proposal?
We need to move approval?
Oh, yeah. I need a motion.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Move for approval.
I'll second.
All right. Have a motion and a second to approve the proposal as submitted for the Doctor of Psychology and Applied Psychology. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Our next item on our agenda has to do with some faculty emeriti positions.
Faculty emeriti. There are two individuals for whom we are requesting emeriti status. There's Lauren Knudsen from the Professor of Art, served at WKU for 39 years. In particular, her stewardship of the printmaking area in that department was tireless. Her teaching was highlighted by creative, well-organized assignments, whether as an instructor of a beginning student or as an advanced art major. As a role model for emerging artists, Professor Knudsen's career could not have been more instrumental, with decades of unwavering commitment to studio practice. Her list of nationally significant solo, small group, and juried competitions provides clear evidence of a highly respected artist, active and relevant in the media of drawing, painting, and printmaking. Also, consideration, Dr. Luann Crowther from the English department, came to WQ in 1984 after completing an undergraduate degree at Heidelberg and a doctorate at Indiana University. The last 30 years, Luann has played a particularly important role in building diversity at WKU. As a junior faculty member, she helped organize the university's first Women's Studies Conference, and she is a central figure in the African American Studies program, particularly through her highly successful course in African American Literature. Luann is a poet who has also written and presented on pedagogical issues. Her scholarship is focused on the Harlem Renaissance, particularly poet and novelist Dorothy Lee Dickens. Luann has also been active in the community beyond the campus through organizations such as Habitat for Humanity and Girls, Inc., and she has taught in the Governor's Scholars Program. And honors include being named a Woman of Achievement by the Bowling Green Human Rights Commission. I'm pleased to recommend these two individuals for emerita status.
Any discussion?
I'm proud to move for approval, and since I'm going to be here at the fourth quarterly meeting on Halloween now, I will have something to say about both of these outstanding faculty who have been very important in my life as a faculty member as well. In fact, it's tough walking into Cherry Hall and not seeing Luann Crowther every day, because literally we came in at the exact same time for 21 years. So it's a big change in my life, and I'd be happy to add some additional comments to the excellent record that the provost put forward. And I love the correctly declined noun, too, on the agenda. Provost Dinsley knows his Latin.
Latin, 5 years of Latin.
I can tell. Well done. Well done.
So we have a motion. Mm-hmm. Do I hear a second?
I'll second.
Have a motion and a second to approve the emeriti positions for the two individuals as described. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. We have a couple of information items on our agenda. And I think Dr. Fox is here perhaps to tell us a little bit about some trends in graduate programs.
As Carl has mentioned, as we elevate into the realm of SACS Level 6, our graduate programs are becoming an increasingly important part of what we do. As a former graduate dean myself for 12 years, I can testify that, you know, the master's degree really has become the career credential in many fields, And yet, graduate education these days faces a number of challenges. A well-known inverse correlation between the strength of the economy and graduate school enrollment. And as the economy recovers, we're seeing similar challenges here. So to address our trends in enrollment and acceptance and graduation rates from our graduate school here, Carl.
Great, thank you. Well, I'm here in mind, body, and spirit. My voice took the day off, so I apologize ahead of time for not being particularly vocal, but I'll do my best. So we can go to the next slide.
You can do it yourself. Look at that.
Okay, good. All right. So just to remind everyone, we have a number of master's degrees, as you can see. We now have 3 doctoral degrees. Hopefully the number 4, which you just approved, will be added. Our students are involved in all of these programs, and we'll see how that goes. So graduate enrollment in terms of Western Kentucky University, you can see we're right around 3,000 students compared to the other comprehensive universities in the state. We clearly lead the state in terms of enrollment with close to 3,000. Our nearest neighbor, Northern Kentucky, at about 2,500 students. We get most of our students from Kentucky. In fact, we get a lot of our students in the graduate programs as graduates from our undergraduate programs at WKU. However, we are seeing increasing numbers of out-of-state students coming into our graduate programs, as well as increasing number of international students. Oops, maybe I'm going the wrong way. Oops. In terms of how we are split enrollment-wise, in terms of master's versus doctoral, we actually compare quite favorably, if you want to look at that, with other universities in the country, where nationally about 74% of enrollment is in master's programs, about 26% in doctoral programs and others. Our average is about 77 and 23. So when you compare us to other universities nationally, we're quite comparable in terms of percent of students in master's programs as compared to students in doctoral programs. We don't just enroll students, as you know. We actually do grant degrees. And so in terms of graduate degree production, we're sitting at almost 1,000 master's and doctoral programs degrees awarded every year. And this puts us quite obviously in the lead compared to other comprehensives in Kentucky. And we see, in fact, this number growing. When you look at where we've been over the last 10 years, we've made a substantial increase in our graduate program enrollment. Nationally, graduate program enrollment has been increasing about 2.5%. For Western Kentucky University, we've actually increased over 10%. You can see that there was a big change in 2009. And to quote a former president, it's the economy, stupid. What happens is that when the economy goes down, actually graduate enrollment typically goes up. You see what happened in 2009, and what happens is a lot of people come back for master's programs in particular. A lot of people come back on a part-time basis for master's and other graduate programs. And that's what we've seen nationally. It's exactly what we've seen at Western Kentucky University. So when you look at that growth and you wonder why we sort of kind of dipped down a little bit, it really is that part-time student component. The economy is growing. People are going back to work. They're not enrolling in programs as they once were. One of the things I'm really proud of that we've done over the last 5 years in terms of our graduate enrollment, particularly compared to other universities nationally, is increased our numbers of underrepresented minority students. This is a really significant increase of 35% over the last 5 years. We've done a tremendous job. And I simply want to point out that Dr. Miller and I worked together on the Minority Assistance Program at the graduate level, which specifically is designed to support underrepresented minority students who enter into and complete graduate programs. This program has been tremendously effective. We wish we had a little more dollars to put into it because we can recruit really, really top students. But we've done very well. When you look at how we compare nationally, we're off the charts compared to most other schools in terms of our underrepresented minority enrollment. And then the other thing to point out about things that have changed over the last 5 years, as you all know, we've added doctoral programs, but we've also increased our doctoral enrollment. And so we're now up to close to 250 doctoral students in our programs, which we see as a place of growth, and with the new SID coming on, further growth in those programs. Some of our programs, of course, like the doctor physical therapy, we have limited capacity, limited enrollment. Nursing is another one, but we still see growth in these areas. As you know, programs kind of are different, and we've seen different kinds of enrollment growth as well as stability depending upon the particular degree program. This particular slide just shows by college, and so I can tell you about specific degree programs, but we've seen somewhat of a decline in our education program, largely due to actually increased competition, particularly for teacher education, and some changes there at the state level. We've seen tremendous growth in the health area, Masters of Public Health, Masters of Healthcare Administration, Kinesiology, Recreation and Sports Medicine. We've seen growth in nursing, of course, for the DPT program. Most of our other programs have stayed steady or have shown some degree of growth. One of the things we've also done is place an emphasis, and this is in our action plan for the university, on the numbers of theses and dissertations. This is where the students really can shine and show their scholarship, show what they can do in terms of their research activity. And we've seen tremendous growth over the last 10 years in terms of numbers of theses and dissertations that our students are completing. We are among the nation's leaders in terms of the number of students we get into doctoral programs, into PhD programs, coming out of our master's programs, largely due to the excellence that happens at the research level in theses and dissertations. I wanted to throw this in sort of at the end to let you know where the Department of Labor sees growth. Where do they see the need for education? And when you look at the numbers, clearly, doctorate, professional, and master's degrees, the expectation is the largest growth, the largest demand for new jobs, new careers, new employment opportunities is going to be at the graduate level. Therefore, we believe that Western Kentucky, we are uniquely positioned to address those needs. And I think, as was mentioned in terms of the SID degree program, we are positioning ourselves, in fact, to meet that demand. It's no longer enough in many, many careers and occupations simply to have a baccalaureate degree. That the master's degree is becoming the degree of choice, and as well as new professional doctoral degree programs such as those that we've implemented. Lastly, I just wanted to give you some idea of a couple of things that we've been doing and are planning to do. We have implemented our so-called JUMP program. JUMP stands for Joint Undergraduate Master's Program. Students who come to Western Kentucky University, who are among our best students, actually can get 2 degrees, typically in 5 years. How do we do that? Because we allow undergraduate students in their juniors and senior year to actually take graduate courses and start to build their master's program. These kinds of programs are really for the top students, the students who are excelling, and we allow them to actually count 12 credits both at the undergraduate and graduate level. We have programs like this, for example, in accounting, applied economics, psychological sciences. These are just some of the things we're doing. This is going to be a tremendous, tremendous advantage for us as a university. We are looking to increase our access through distance learning and through DLO. We expect that to increase. One of the things you see nationally is competency-based degree programs. I know that Beth is looking at that, and we're looking to push the idea of how can we really assess competency and get people into degree programs to get them through.
Excuse me, interrupt. Could you explain competency-based degree programs? Because I'm not sure I understand that.
So I'll give you an example. The University of Wisconsin, through the Department of Extension, is looking for assessment tools that can allow individuals to earn credits, if you will, without necessarily sitting in a class for a certain period of time. For example,
If you've been a practicing professional in a particular area and have developed competencies in a discipline, through various assessment tools, we can actually award you the equivalent of credits, which can then count toward degree programs.
Okay.
It's a way to get you through a degree program without having to spend hours in the classroom. You know, if you already have the knowledge and know the materials. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me add that. In addition to credit for prior learning, there are a lot of universities moving toward, they need a competency transcript. Rather than measuring academic or learning by credit hours and time in seat, they're measuring it by what have you learned, what have you achieved, what knowledge and skills do you have. And we're looking at developing programs that will have, in parallel with the traditional academic transcript measured in credit hours, a list of, you know, skills and knowledge that you have acquired. And there's a lot of crosstalk.
How's that measured? How do you assess that document what one knows?
I didn't bring an example with me, Gary, but it has not replaced the traditional transcript, but it has a supplement to it that says, has worked in teams with other individuals to solve a project, and you get, you know, certain courses will lead to development of that competency. Has developed oral and written communication skills is a competency, and various courses can feed into that single competency, and you can
principally by exam, or how does one demonstrate their skills?
Like any other graded material, exam, performance, a dissertation defense, a thesis defense.
I'm like Patty. This is a growing phenomenon, but it's a phenomenon that I am not yet fully
familiar with
or comfortable with, but that doesn't mean that I won't be. I just, it's something that I want to track. Because as we move into this, and I expect we probably will, higher education will probably be moving in this direction in due course.
Yeah.
I just want to be sure that all of the measures can be well documented and demonstrated.
Yeah.
If we're going to put our name on it for a competency-based
right.
degree.
It's one of those things that when I first did study abroad, for example, and I went to my faculty training, one of the things they stamped into your head was time in field as equivalent to time in classroom, because they said we have to demonstrate to SACS that we're not just selling credit to people. And that's one of those things that just got stamped into my head.
That's still true.
Yeah.
You recall the board approved about 6 months ago a reorganization of our manufacturing sciences curriculum into one credit hour modules, which are more competency-based than a traditional three credit hour course might be. And in fact, there's some economy in doing that. We are, the state's idea of a Commonwealth College for adult learners will be largely online, on-demand, competency-based. Students can proceed at their own pace rather than learning in a semester-based format. If you want to go faster and achieve those competencies faster than a three-credit hour course might allow you to, you can. If you want to go a little slower, we break it down into smaller units so that the students can proceed at their own pace.
Are there any degree programs that you know of that where a complete degree is awarded based solely on competency-based demonstration?
Actually, postgraduate medical education has been using this for about 10 years, and they divide it up into five or six different categories. Some are easier to deal with than others. Some are strictly knowledge, which you can test for.
Right.
But some of them have to do with communication skills, and a few of our, looks like our psychologists have left, but, you know, when we're talking about producing doctorate-level psychologists, you know, it's not going to be enough just to know the stuff.
Right.
The ones that are going to be in demand and who you want are going to have great communication skills. So what I'm getting to is it depends a lot on a mentor, and some of it gets pretty subjective,
right.
You know.
Right.
Some of it has to do with how well you can use technology and apply it to what you're doing. So there are different categories of competency that some are measurable, some are not.
Well, change and adapt. I just want to be sure that when we change and adapt, we're thorough and
absolutely. We haven't implemented any of this, but,
that's right.
But we want to make sure that we're there.
Well, this will be an ongoing discussion that we'll have
absolutely.
Over time.
And you may want to get some of the material from some of the postgraduate medical education sources that utilize, have been utilizing it for a long time.
The other area of growth we've seen is in graduate certificate programs, and we've had seen tremendous enrollment growth there. A lot of professionals are not looking for another degree. They're looking for a certificate that gives them the skills and knowledge they need in their careers. These are typically around 12 credits, sometimes a little more. And what we do with the certificate programs is allow them to then feed into a master's program. So you can start with a certificate, you know, add another 18 credits and have a master's level. So this model, I think, will continue. And again, it meets employer needs, it meets employee needs, and it really helps people in their careers. And then on the more traditional side, as we seek to grow our traditional on-campus programs, particularly those that are more focused on research and a research-based master's, we're going to be looking to actually increase our competitiveness for support of those students. So that means looking for additional funds outside the university, help us do that through grants, contracts, fellowships, other kinds of support mechanisms.
Can I ask a question about that as well?
Sure.
That's actually the one piece that I've been asked about by a number of colleagues who work with graduate students. And their concern was changes in the graduate assistant program this year. If you could address that there were fewer graduate assistantships, fewer of the super GA positions.
So what we did was we took a little bit of the funds from the so-called super GA funds that we had gotten through the provost office to create what we call graduate student research fellowships. The idea behind the fellowships is to be able to be more competitive in terms of the marketplace to recruit those truly outstanding students who wanted to come into and begin and complete our master's programs. And the way we ran the program is it had to be a team. In other words, a faculty member would nominate a student. That student would then be working with that faculty member in a mentor-mentee relationship on a particular area of scholarship. So we created, this last year, we created 20 graduate student research fellowships. And I can tell you I had over 75 applications for these fellowships, and we turned down students who came in with undergraduate GPAs well over 3.5. The competition was so tight that we only could fund a very, very select group of students. And we believe that this is going to be a way of really improving not only the scholarship of those students and increasing the level of our competitiveness and the scholarly productivity of our graduate programs, but also providing our faculty, those highly qualified students that work with them in a one-on-one relationship and on their scholarship as well. So all the fellowships were formed across all the colleges, not in an even manner. It's a competitive program. It's much like the National Science Foundation runs a graduate student fellowship program. So it's a little bit of an experiment to see if, in fact, we can attract those really, really top students to our university. And we'll see. The jury is obviously still out. We've only done once.
Okay. And I think the concern is, I'm just going to throw this out there, the concern is that that's a model that you just described. That's a scientific model. You work one-on-one with the faculty member on their research, whereas if you're in a humanities program, for example, or a fine arts program, you're much more of a solo practitioner. I don't have somebody who works with me on my research, I don't have somebody who's going to co-author pieces with me. It's my show. I might have someone assisting me with finding some things. So I think one of the concerns they had is that, that there are some strong programs outside of the experimental sciences that could also attract those kind of really sharp students. Because we've sent people on to top-ranked doctoral programs this year, out of my program, for example. And I think there's the concern that we wouldn't be able to produce another one of those if we...
I can tell you one of the most competitive programs for these fellowships was our folk studies program.
They're a practicum-based program. So.
Their level of scholarship is extraordinary, and I think they're unique among universities in the country. So, you're right. But
it's not a one-size-fits-all model for
graduate. Yeah, the fellowships actually were awarded across all the colleges. We you know, you award the best students, and it's based on their undergraduate track record. It's also based on the scholarship of the faculty that you're putting them in. We have scholars in the College of Business as well. Fellowships were awarded there too. So there was no intent that it would be, you know, a science-centric kind of program.
Yeah, that's food for thought. Maybe just continue that dialogue with your graduate advisors in the departments.
Absolutely.
How will the Master of Philosophy degree be woven throughout these talking points that we see here as that program winds its way through the process this fall?
That will be really akin to a kind of a jump program A lot of the students that will be engaged in the MPhil degree program are going to be our honors students.
Right.
So it really will be one of those where those students will be able to, again, get basically two degrees in 5 years. And right now it looks like that program will initiate in kinesiology, recreation, and sports management. That's where we're going to start. But I think that program will have a home, I mean, across the whole campus. There's really no reason that it can't find a home across all of our degree programs.
And so most jump programs will typically take about 5 years.
Yeah.
You add an extra year, but you complete a master's and baccalaureate at the same simultaneously.
Exactly. And there's 12 credits that are shared between the two degrees, so that, in some sense, that shortens the time. However, I have to tell you, not every student can get into the jump program. We have very strict in the department-based requirements for students to be accepted into that program. And not every undergraduate automatically gets into the jump. Some of the programs have undergrad GPA requirements of 3.25, for example. You have to have completed 60 credits, and you have to have, you know, certain kinds of grades in the major. So it's a selective process for students to get into the jump program. And really, honestly, the students that can do it are our best students. Our best undergraduates are the ones that can actually get into those jump programs and get the 2 degrees in the 5 years. And it's really a way, in some ways, of rewarding those students who, you know, they work hard, incredibly diligent. They're recognized at the undergraduate level as being some of our best and stellar students.
So. I think for most honors students, Guy, in fact, I think 4 years is a more realistic. A jump program is basically a baccalaureate program plus 4 courses plus a thesis. Now, honors students will be doing a honors thesis anyway. We'd replace that with the master's thesis. So it's really one set of 4 courses, and with all the AP credits and so forth that our honors college students typically bring with them, it's not unreasonable to expect that to be completed within the normal 4-year period. In fact, I'm not sure it would even take 5.
Depends, yeah.
And you say that's hitting the curriculum approval process in this quarter?
I believe it's going through the college process at this point.
In HHS?
No, and university college, because it will be awarded by through the Honors Academy and the Honors College.
Dr. Fox, thank you for a very good presentation.
Thank you.
Did you have anything else?
Nope, that's it for me. Thank
you.
Does
anyone have any other questions or comments? Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our last information item. Brian has moved into the hot box. And
the hot box.
Not to steal any thunder from the Student Affairs Committee, but what's the name of the restaurant that just opened?
Steak and Shake.
I noticed that we had more people signing up for our meal plan than ever before. It outnumbered.
There you go.
And maybe it's because of Steak and Shake.
You don't recommend your patients go to Steak and Shake, Philip?
Well, let me segue from that, Rita Bill. Part of the reason I think you're seeing more people signing up for the meal plan is we have more full-time residential students. About a year ago, I presented to the board of enrollment profile called the Changing Academic Profile at WKU, with emphasis on growing our cohort of first-time, full-time, baccalaureate-seeking students, growing the quality of that cohort, and increasing the retention rate of that cohort, and I think you'll be fairly pleased with what Brian has to say in that area. Brian.
Thank you, Provost Emsley. It's good to hear Dr. Fox's presentation, because graduate enrollment and graduate studies are doing a lot of great things, and that's one piece of the story. As Paul Harvey used to say, here's the rest of the story and your snapshot that's floating around to you. The board may recall last September we probably didn't give you, or we did not give you, this sort of detail, because we don't do that normally until October, closer to census, which is around October 24th or 25th. Board meeting will be on the 31st, so we should have even more granular detail than's floating to you. But the enrollment arms race continues to surge forward. We continue to be evolving and moving the enrollment profile forward. We are seeing very meaningful shifts in the look and the feel of the incoming class, and we anticipated such shifts. This is a fifth week enrollment report, snapshot, if you will, characteristics of where we are this week in the process regarding the class as well as overall enrollment metrics. And keep in mind, as you recall, in fall of 12, we increased the admission standards, which set forth in motion many dynamic changes. One primary change and goal was to increase the academic quality of the student body, providing the faculty with college-ready students ready for the rigor and success, and we believe that we are seeing some of that. If you look at your top of your graph there on the fifth week report, that's a 15-year trend graph of enrollment over the last decade and a half of where we have been and how enrollment has grown and moved forward. Down below that, just overall, and again, this is a snapshot of this week. The story is still not over because the census is a month away. The numbers here from versus 2013 versus 2014 are very consistent in what we've been reporting to the board, but also seeing in our enrollment dynamic that our part-time as well as non-traditional numbers lagging a bit or falling off. Again, we believe that to be, as Dean Fox said in his presentation, a byproduct of the economy. And you'll see some of the retention bubble still with us. It has to work its way through, and we're working on that accordingly. International enrollments are looking strong, but you see again the non-traditional and part-time is really pulling on that number. If you move to the right side of the snapshot, enrollment by student type, the first-time full-time baccalaureate cohort. This is the cohort that we're benchmarked on. Everything is set forward on with CPE and everything else with our six-year graduation rate. That is up. It is up from last year. If you recall, last year was up from the previous year, approximately 30 students. When it says other freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors, that's that retention bubble making its way through. Undergraduate other would be our high school dual credit program, our non-degree post-bac students. A non-degree, that's a pretty high number, positive 150. That takes into account our cohorts of our Brazilian students that we're seeing here with us, and a lot of positive results out of that. And Rosa Tawana actually has been in Brazil this past week to make sure that relationship is long-term and continuing, and you know they're going to send us another group this spring and again in the fall. Dr. Fox mentioned the graduate students. If you flip the the report over to the backside, again, you see the first time breaking it down, first time full-time baccalaureate, some very positive metrics there. Again, that cohort size is up. The retention rate is improving up to 74%. Average ACT, 23.4%, and high school GPA has improved up to 3.33. The section under that is everyone. That's everyone meaning the part-time, associate degree seekers, everybody else. And still the metrics are trending very positively with retention, ACT, and GPA. Top right corner, college readiness of first-time students. Overall, the areas that we're engaged on or that we monitor through the math, English, and reading skills for the class of 2014. All those are up, and it's one of some of the largest increases we've seen in that college readiness. Again, we believe that's a byproduct of raising those admission standards as well as working closely with our regional high schools. Dale Brown and Sharon Hunter have worked very closely with the high schools in presenting to students and family members on what it takes to be ready for college and starting earlier and earlier than their senior year, dipping down even into eighth and ninth grade now. International enrollment's holding very strong. Direct admits You know, sitting at 657 right now, all our pathway programs, Novitas, CSLI, they're all trending as expected, as we anticipated them to. No reason to believe that will slow down. In January, you'll see that continue to increase, and fall of 15 as well. The bottom half of the page, I want to put that out there for you at this time, because this graph really shows the overall success of our students and graduation rates. You know, WKU is hovering around that 50.1%, where the rest of the comprehensives in Kentucky are at 48%. If you go across where it says 11.4%, that's transferred to other schools and graduated. The 17.9% is transferred, no degree awarded. But equally important here, and the provost and I discussed this earlier, that the 4.6% still enrolled at WKU. So you're going to see that 50.1 grow as in future reports, which is a positive indicator. And all that information we can retrieve from the National Clearinghouse. We can see where people are going or not going, for that matter. And then you see the growing number of degrees awarded over the last several years. And, of course, as you graduate more students, that absolutely affects enrollment. Now, again, I mentioned this as a snapshot of this week. I mean, we still have bi-term. You still have a lot of add and drop. You still have drop for non-payment, which is October 7th. So this is going to be dynamic, organic, if you will. It's going to be growing and changing in the coming weeks. So when we come back to you on October 31st, you'll see the actual census report that we turn into CPE. Because this year the board report falls a few days after that, and IR will have time to prep that for you. But we want to go ahead and at least give you some granular detail here in late September, where we've not done that in the past. So that's sort of a snapshot of where we are, and I can speak about other things where we're going if you like to, but are we going to address questions, or did I leave anything out, Provost?
The drop for non-payment period actually began this week and goes on through next week. Well, into the following week, I guess. And that's a very significant and tenuous period, because there will be a number of students that will not have paid and were arriving at a threshold by which they will be dropped, and then we will communicate one-on-one with them. Many will re-enroll as they find a way to pay the bill. Some of them, oh, you mean you were serious about it? Which is what you deal with, but that's a significant number. You know, we may be dealing with hundreds, maybe even more, of students that will be dropped for non-payment and then readmitted, hopefully in as timely a manner as possible, so as not to disrupt their course schedule. But it's a stressful period for students, and our bursar's office and our financial aid office staff are working hard to work one-on-one. Communicate with these students and help get them on a payment plan to where their bill is paid by the time classes will begin for the spring semester, which is the goal.
A couple of things to add to that is, we do drop for non-payment. As President Renzel says, sometimes they just didn't know, and the recovery is almost complete for cohort students.
Yes.
Most students that we drop do make it back in. What you lose on that is the non-cohort students. So as our profile shifts to more cohort, we expect that to be a down and up again.
And every college and university deals with a number of students who applied, were admitted, enrolled, registered for classes, maybe even paid some money, but didn't show. And you don't know that until you go through this period to know with certainty. So it's a fluid number for the next month or so until the final census takes place.
And Ann's offices with Belinda and the Bursar and Student Financial Aid with Cindy Burnett, I mean, they literally are reaching out to these students, either email, phone call, very individually trying to work with them on payment plans, either through TMS or through our offices, which are even more creative payment plans, if you will.
TMS?
The software that helps guide the...
Brian, I don't know if this is in your lane of travel or not. Obviously, I was just trying to apply some math numbers to the where we stand. Have you done that, or is that an AME question?
Which one, math and...
I mean, budget impact is what I was
with the out-of-state and the international cohorts, revenue seems to be trending as expected in a comfortable pace. Now, President, Provost, would you...
We are cautiously optimistic that we'll be at a break-even basis on enrollment and revenue. And that's the goal. That's the minimum goal. But it'll be fairly close. We're losing some, as we did last year, part-time, non-traditional students, many white females in graduate programs, and you saw Carl's numbers, and you see the numbers on this sheet. So that's a number that we're still losing, but we are making up for it with the full-time cohort and the international. So right now, we it looks like we're going to be at a break-even basis on revenue.
When you say break-even budget?
Right. We meet our budget.
Meet your budget.
But I do not expect a significant budgetary growth dynamic that maybe we were experiencing when we were growing by hundreds of students each year for a period of years. But I also don't expect a major budgetary hit. But that won't be finally known until this drop for non-payment period ends, the final census is taken, and we can balance numbers and dollars.
And Brian mentioned the bubble. I'd like to point out that we have a bubble of a positive sense. I would really draw attention to that top left of the back sheet, where our retention rate, thanks to the efforts of Darrell Davis Carter and the folks in student retention, our retention task force, which is faculty staff representation, that 2.5 percentage points increase in 1 year is pretty impressive, to go from 71.5 to 74. Those are students who will go on to become juniors and seniors, and that's a positive bubble that will start having an impact on overall enrollment numbers. The 6.1 percentage point increase retention rate of the non-cohort is, frankly, to me, astonishing. That's great, to go from 65 to over 70% in 1 year. We're doing an excellent job of keeping the students that we enroll, and that will have very positive implications for future enrollment. It really will. The other thing, there's this frequent thing that we have a graduation rate of just over 50%, and that is frequently stated as only half of the students who enroll graduate. As you can see from the graph, that is just not true. 11% have transferred and graduated elsewhere. 5% are still enrolled and will graduate from here. 17.9% have transferred to someone else, and presumably most of those will graduate too. And if you add those up, that's over 80% of students are successful after enrolling in college. This IPEDS number of students that have to be first-time, full-time, and graduate from your institution to be counted sometimes paints a different picture than reality. Students are much more successful than 50%.
I had a couple of questions. You have the first time, the number that we need, the first time, full time. But what about one stat I don't see here, and I know it's an important one, is sophomore junior retention. What does that look like?
What is that? Are we still at 90% sophomore junior?
That's much higher, yes.
It's typically...
You can include that in the October 31st report.
Sure.
That would be fine.
I mean, the biggest hit is the freshman and sophomore.
Absolutely.
Clearly, that's the biggest challenge for us, and that's 73% to 75%. But sophomore to junior, once they get past that freshman to sophomore, re-enrolled for their sophomore year, then it's a much higher number going forward. But
I'm just curious about the trend lines there, because that's one of those things I'm just kind of picking up on the frequencies, I guess is what you'd say, is hearing a little bit more about some transfer at that level. And it seems like I'm just hearing that more, but I don't have any data to support that. It's just something I'm hearing.
The other thing I'd be curious of, I guess, Brian, is our junior to senior retention rate for transfer students, which I'll bet is actually very high.
It is.
But we haven't looked. I haven't looked at that recently. So.
The other question I had is on the front of the sheet about the decline in underrepresented minority and the non-underrepresented minority students. And I'm sure that we've taken a pretty careful look at that. And what do we think is going on there?
I would say the not underrepresented minority or white female graduate students and teachers getting master's degrees, it's become increasingly difficult to compete with the small private institutions that are putting a price point way below
that's one under
our market rate.
They're both falling, if I may, at about an equal rate. If you notice, it's about 3%. And if you look, the distribution of part-time students in both of those groups has been fairly consistent. So we're getting hit in both places. We did look at that in some additional detail, and actually the decline in the non-underrepresented minorities, we can make it more complicated, has been larger than the minority decrease simply because of the numbers. There's a much larger group of them than there are under the underrepresented minorities. But it seems to be consistent with what we're seeing, and it has 12 to 13 is a much larger change. 13 to 14, we seem to be evening out, and I think we'll see that tilt back up again, depending upon the economy.
Okay, so we think that's money.
Changing emission standards affects that too.
Okay.
So the decline in graduate students of 228, that is more in the education.
Yeah, you recall from Carl's graphs, it's largely in graduates and mostly part-time students. We are competing.
Would it be fair to say mostly teachers?
And college of education.
I'd like to let me answer that. It's almost all part-time students. We've actually seen an increase in our full-time graduate students. It's largely, Scott has run the numbers, it's all part-time students. So that's where you see that.
Many of them teachers,
yes,
getting master's degrees?
Exactly.
And you can now pursue an alternative route to certification that does not involve a master's degree, and it's tough to compete with that.
It's killing us.
How do you determine college readiness the first time students?
ACT scores in the sub-disciplines, the English, the reading, and the math.
Our coordinator of college readiness is behind us.
I was going to say, me. For that one, math 19 and 22. If you only require a general math course, liberal arts, non-scientific, 19 will make you college ready. 22, which just went up to 27 for the sciences. 20 in reading.
27 for the sciences in college ready?
Yes, because it used to be 22, and then we looked at moving it up, and those are nationally designated numbers from ACT based on national research. So we're ramping those up slowly. The English is 18, and Kentucky took a look at those when we were working on this with the passage of Senate Bill 1. And we backed off on a couple. Reading, 21 is what ACT says. But that would double the number of students at that point, which would have been non-college ready. But with the gains that we're seeing, and are reflected here, the schools are putting out a lot more college-ready students, and they're ready now to step into a four-year public institution. So we couldn't do that without our partners. Dale and I have been out talking with them, and you can see, if you look at the Kentucky High School feedback reports, they are making significant strides, and that makes our job much easier.
I don't see it listed on here, but unless I'm missing it, transfer students. Do you have a number related to transfer?
It is not all. The transfer numbers are up approximately 97, right at
95. I think I briefed the board in one of my communiques with you that I spent an entire week, 2 weeks ago, visiting each of our seven joint admissions partner community colleges in Kentucky, and then I'll go to Volunteer State in Gallatin, Tennessee, I think, next week. Meeting with students, but also meeting with the presidents and academic officers and faculty and other administrators on those campuses, and trying to further strengthen those relationships with those community colleges that encircle us. Trying to drive up the transfer numbers, and I felt good about the productivity gained during that week of visits, and a lot of people worked hard. Let's see, Dennis George and his team here, but a lot of people worked hard to prepare for those visits, and they were quite, we also went in most of the high schools within easy vicinity of each of those community colleges while we were there, mm-hmm. while we were in that part of the state as well. So it was a week well spent.
The and you're right, transfers aren't addressed there and should be, but that's a positive plus. You don't usually see transfer numbers 90-plus up in a fall semester. That's usually a January number, but I think that's a byproduct of what Dr. Ransdell mentioned, the relationships with the KCTCS partners.
We're trying to probe every market niche. We're staying focused on the traditional market niche that's been our bread and butter, but we're trying to really probe on every other market niche as well, where maybe we haven't placed as much emphasis in the past, and it's going to be an important, you know, that while we're studying these numbers and the financial aid office staff and the bursar's office staff are communicating one-on-one with students dropped for non-payment, the admissions and recruiting staff has long since forgotten about this business. I mean, they're right in the heart of building next year's class. In fact, tomorrow we'll have 1,200 prospective students and their families on campus for a focus on WKU weekend. And we are well into high school visits and all the traditional things that admissions officers do. And open houses and the whole schedule is running at full speed right now, building for next year's class. So this art and science is a rich combination of both, and we're trying to assess when to apply which, and it takes both art and science.
Interesting point there. Jace told me, and Jace couldn't be here with us today, he's working recruiting, but the apps for fall 15 are well over 300 apps already. That's highly unusual in our historical application dynamic for August, September. And then the open house numbers are halfway through the open houses where we go across Kentucky recruiting open houses. Those numbers have doubled. So it's not just, you know, 10 or 20. And again, that's the byproduct of the communication efforts, I think, marketing.
Brian, may I ask a question? I mentioned to you in the hall, do you give numbers of how our enrollment is trending in relationship to other universities? I know we have universities we compare ourselves to in the fact book, but I think I mentioned to you I heard some pretty dire straits with a university that shares 231 with us in Tennessee. Highway 231, excuse me.
I have not. We certainly monitor that and keep an eye on the competitors and across Kentucky and Tennessee. But
PBS, it was on the national PBS, and they were just crying the blues, it appeared. So I don't know. That was just a couple of days ago. So.
The higher ed number dynamic, I think, across the country is changing, and it's schools, you know, it's up and down. But there's a vast majority of the four-year schools that are seeing, you know, total change in their enrollment profile. But, yeah, we do monitor the other schools and absolutely our comprehensives and the Kentucky schools. Got to know where we compare and fall out. We'll be back in October.
We'll have final profile October 31.
Okay, thank you very much, Brian. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the academic committee.
I'll direct your attention to an action item for the executive committee on pages 1 and 2 of the report. Is proposal to approve the statement of purpose. And as you see from reading the report, the current statement of purpose was promulgated in 2007. And this is really basically an edit to update the information in it and to eliminate references that are no longer relevant. And
primarily prepared.
Do recall the July board. The board approved a revised statement of purpose subject to ratification by the University Senate. The Senate met last Thursday and made one alteration to that, namely striking the sentence in the beginning of the second paragraph. And so we're returning this to the board for approval of the amended statement of purpose with that deletion.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Motion is made and second. Any questions? Call the question. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Passes unanimously.
Maybe a record of executive committee meeting, right?
It's usually that.
Ridley, Finance and Budget Committee.
We have two act-